If you use the internet on a daily basis, and chances are you do, you probably don't put much thought into cybersecurity. You know, your network connections, the pages you visit, the files you download. You should be thinking about these all the time. Welcome to And Security for All. Your host is Kim Hakem. We're here to help you understand, in general terms, how and why your cybersecurity should be kept in check. Now, here is Kim Hakem.
Hello, everyone. Happy Friday. Welcome to another episode of And Security for All. I am your host, Kim Hakem. Thank you so much for joining us again today. Last week, I was out in Utah where it is crazy. I just got a text that they are getting from right now until Monday, 30 to 50 inches of snow. They said they're going to get an inch every hour. So that's about 4 feet of snow. And they already have tons. I am in the Midwest waiting for that winter storm to roll through here. We are going down to about -2 or -3. I guess for you guys out in Minneapolis, you guys are used to that. But I'm here in St. Louis and we are going to, looks like we're going to hibernate all weekend because we're getting some cold weather and some ice coming in. So interesting times with the climate. I know we have listeners from all around the world and a lot around North America. So I hope wherever you are staying warm. For those of you that don't know, FutureCon, I'm the CEO of FutureCon as well. We host cybersecurity conferences all over North America. And we just got our little yearly break that we get once a year. We take off from, not really take off, but we stop doing our shows. We do about 29 shows. And from the second week to December until the second or third week of January, our team host no shows. We're going back on the road next week. We're going out to Los Angeles. We're super excited for our first kickoff event next week in Los Angeles. We have 3 in a row, and then we go to the Windy City, and then we go to Dallas, where my guest is from today. So if you guys are out there in one of those regions, we'd love to see you in person. You can just go to FutureCon events and register for any of our events. And all of our events stream in a hybrid mode. So check us out. We have some really great speakers and we'd love to see you. So today I am very excited for my guest. He has been on the show in the past and he has frequently, he's a few times has been a keynote speaker at our events in Dallas. Today I have Philip Wiley. He's the director of security at Alias Cybersecurity. And he also last week, Jonathan Kimmett, who is the CISO over there. Jonathan, he does guest hosts a lot of these shows when I'm out of town. And Philip and Jonathan work together. Philip has authored many books and I'm very excited to have him back as a guest. Today, we're going to talk about the Pen Tester's Playbook, a deep dive into offensive security tactics. So, Philip, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to see you, and I look forward to FutureCon at the end of the month here in Dallas.
So. Yeah, we're really excited for that. That's going to be, you know, we always have that at the House of Blues. And I don't know if you know the CISO, Jeff Kirby. Do you know Jeff Kirby?
Yes, sure do.
He is wrapping up the day. He has his band, and he's doing some cybersecurity. They're doing from 5:30 to 6:30 after the event at the House of the Blues. His band is called Skeptor, and they have like some cybersecurity rock and roll. And that event afterwards is always a fun event. So hopefully you'll be there and join the fun festivities during the day and then afterwards.
Yeah, I knew about his band, but I haven't heard him yet. So I look forward to hearing his band. And for anyone that's in the area or any of the areas that the FutureCon events are on, I really recommend it because especially some people that don't like really huge crowds, it's kind of a nice size audience that it's not too crowded and makes it easier to network. So it's a really great event. And I do like that you've continued to do these hybrid, you know, because we had so much hybrid stuff during the pandemic. But there's some people that can't afford to travel these places and some people just aren't comfortable in crowds, even though, you know, we're kind of on the other side of the pandemic now. But I think it's great that you offer that, you know, people that are immunocompromised or just don't feel safe. But it's great that you're doing that.
Yeah, and it's not even really about, like, you know, COVID or anything about that. It's just the profession that we're in. There's so many people that just cannot leave their office. They just can't get away. And they love that we offer them that resource and they can still get their CPEs and they can still kind of watch all the fun we're having. And it really works out great because normally once they see it virtually, they want to come and they end up eventually coming when we come to a city near them. It's just something that's the new way that we run things. And we'll probably always keep it that way because it's just a great way to spread all of, you know, we get so many great speakers. We want to make sure that we're putting, you know, our speakers out there to as many people as possible. So tell us, Philip, about, like, you had a big transition. How did that, you were, prior to that, you were working for, who was it again? I forgot who you were
before
with.
I came to work for Alias, I was working at Scythe.
Okay. And yeah, then you were launching some books. You just had, didn't you just release another book in the past year?
No new books. Just still the one, the Pentester Blueprint. Although I've got a couple ideas for a couple different books. Wiley, my publisher on my book, I have an idea for them. And then No Starch Press also approached me about writing a book for them. So a couple ideas on that. So we'll see. The one for No Starch would be a pen testing book. So, and I'm also a podcaster too. So for those that don't know me, I host the Philip Wiley Show. And previously I hosted the Hacker Factory, which I won a SANS Difference Makers Award for last month.
Well, tell us a little bit about your career before we jump into it, because today we're going to talk about, I told everyone, that Pentester's Playbook, a deep dive into offensive security tactics. But give us a little background on you and, you know, some of your, you know, some of your past experience and what you've been doing with, you know, some of the pen testing you've been doing in the past and just your history.
Sure. So I got my start before I got into cybersecurity. I worked as a system administrator for a little over 6 years. And then in 2004, this year makes my 20th year anniversary of moving over to cybersecurity. So I started out doing network security. So we managed firewalls, intrusion detection systems, as well as did some risk assessments of vulnerability scans. And then about 2005, the company I worked for had a new CISO come in. He had a more modern idea of the way security organizations were operating. So he created a application security group and I moved over to the application security group. I was managing our third party pen test as well as doing some application security vulnerability scanning and really got interested in pen testing, took some different courses on pen testing. And then in 2012, I got laid off from my job and I applied for a job at Verizon on their consulting team as a penetration tester. So that's kind of where I got started. So I've been on the offensive side coming up on 12 years. So it's out of all the different areas I've worked in my career, this is the one I've been in the longest and the one I've enjoyed the most. And kind of what got me interested in that is when I was a kid, it got me interested in the whole hacking thing. When I was a kid, a toddler, my dad used to take apart my toys, you know, these different mechanical electronic toys to see how they work. And it was kind of a bad thing because a good thing for me, but mom didn't like it too well because we were taking our toys apart. And so that's what got me curious to that. But it's a really interesting area. And I think one of the things, and you know, last time I was on, we talked more about pen testing careers, but I think this time, you know, we're focusing more on how people can leverage penetration tests, the different types of assessments, and offensive security as a whole. There's a lot of good opportunities there, but there are a lot of gaps. People miss a lot of things when it comes to pen testing. They usually take that checkbox approach. It's required for compliance. That's the only reason that they're doing it. And there's a lot of other areas that they're not having assessments done on that could be leveraged by threat actors that maybe you have a really secure network, but maybe your physical controls aren't good. Someone's able to get into your building, gain access to a system, and you don't have to be able to hack into a system. Someone walks away from their computer and leaves it open. So there's a lot of opportunities for people to get better value out of their assessments.
Can you tell us a little bit of what does it look like to be a pen tester and what does your job like? Tell us exactly, because not everyone, you know, not everyone really understands what a pen tester does.
Sure. And one thing is just for anyone from a career perspective that's looking at it, it looks fun. It is a fun job if you like that. But one of the things you have to really be passionate about pen testing if you go into it, because sometimes we work some crazy hours. Sometimes organizations want us to do our testing after hours, not to take any systems down. Maybe it's a bank and you need any of the applications used for banking to properly function. Sometimes if you're performing a pen test, you might accidentally take down a system. So a lot of cases, they want this done after hours. So if you're someone that doesn't like to be up really late and work crazy hours, this may not be the job for you. I've worked lots of projects where, you know, we started after business hours, and then I've worked on some projects for like a large global airlines once where our testing hours were from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And so it's a fun job. You get to do the hacking piece, but sometimes there are pieces that we do as pen testers that can be kind of boring, like running the vulnerability scans. When we're running our vulnerability scans against our targets that are in scope for the pen test, we have to go back and validate those findings. And sometimes things like certificate related TLS and SSL related findings can be kind of boring to validate, because when you're performing a pen test, you're not only, you know, you run the vulnerability scanners, sometimes it finds false positives. So you have to go back and validate that it is a true finding and not a false positive. And then as a pen tester, you go in and try to exploit or hack those vulnerabilities. So we're trying to find any vulnerability that can be exploited to getting access to the system. And we'll make sure we're testing all those. We don't want to leave anything missing, because if you go through and something's missing, a threat actor can come in and exploit that. And one of the importance of why we need to do offensive security, pen testing is just a part of that, is when you think about companies, they're worried about getting hacked by malicious hackers. And I say malicious hackers because there's people like myself and team members that were hackers, were professional hackers or ethical hackers, sometimes referred to white hat hackers. But we're doing this for good. And there's malicious hackers. So you always hear companies are worried about being hacked, worried about hackers or threat actors. So the best way to protect and find those vulnerabilities is to do it from a threat actor perspective.
So let's just, how do you break that down when we look into like the deep dive into offensive security? What is a blueprint of that? If you're going into a company and, you know, this is new to a company and they're like, we don't even know anything about pen testing. We just want to make sure we're not going to be hacked. So how do you describe that to the non-security professional when you walk into their company to try to get them to protect themselves?
Yeah. One of the things that's a good idea to do first, especially considering if the company hasn't really had much pen testing done, maybe they're new to pen testing, then it's good to do a baseline security assessment. And that's where the team comes in. We're running some scans. We're looking for the low-hanging fruit, things that are very obvious and risky findings. We look for all those. We look for any kind of possible physical security issues. We do a report. And then from there, we kind of decide what needs to be done pen testing-wise. You know, if you've got a lot of applications, and most companies are going to have some kind of network, whether you have host cloud-based or on-prem or hybrid, then you kind of assess what needs to be tested from there. And so one of the things too that needs to be explained is you hear a lot of times offensive security being generalized as red teaming, and that's really not the correct term. A penetration test is where you perform a test where you're looking for all the vulnerabilities that can be exploited and hack all those vulnerabilities to see what can happen if you're able to exploit that vulnerability. Are you able to get access to data? Are you able to elevate your privileges to a higher level user that may have access to data that a regular user may not? But when you get to the red team, we're doing more with a pen test. People are being notified, so that way they know it's not malicious activity and they know to talk to the security team that's doing the pen test to make sure if some strange activity is going on, they can validate that. But when you're doing a red team operation, this is going unknown. There's a control group, usually the CISOs in the control group, very few people, because part of the red team, you're testing the defenders. You're making sure that they're detecting any kind of malicious activity. They're reporting it, testing their incident response plan and all that. So you're testing the people and the technology, but you don't want to tip off the defenders. If they know you're coming, then you know they may be able to find you, and you're really wanting to see what would happen. More like a real world threat actor attack. So you're trying to test it from that perspective. And, you know, and you hear some companies that are doing it right. They really have their security set up optimally. I've heard of companies that had incident response retainers with companies. And during these red team operations, they actually called the company they had the retainer with because they thought they were being attacked. This is a perfect example of the way you should operate, but that's the advantage to a red team operation. You're testing the defenders and you're testing the technology and all the procedures. So we need to know that there's differences between that. So,
well, I see Jonathan Kimmett has joined our show earlier. I just noticed he had a few comments. So thanks, Jonathan, for joining us. And one of the things that he had a question, and it maybe goes hand in hand with what I just kind of was talking about. Do you think that an organization that does have a security staff could benefit from a pen test?
Yes, I think everyone can benefit from a pen test. You really need to be doing pen tests because, you know, you're trying to protect against those threat actors. If you don't have pen testers, whether they're your own or a third party doing consulting for you, if you don't find it, the bad guys are going to find it. And you can just kind of see the breaches are more and more. You know, whenever I first started in security 20 years ago, you didn't see the amount of breaches that we do nowadays, which is kind of interesting. It's tougher to hack into stuff nowadays, but the threat actors are getting smarter. And now you've got the availability of AI through ChatGPT to help you in your attempts. So it's getting a lot more difficult. So companies really need to be doing pen tests. There's really no excuse not to be doing pen testing because you can run your vulnerability scans and you may see these vulnerabilities, but you're not really going to know what's possible. And even if it's exploitable, there could be mitigating controls that maybe that Nessus vulnerability scanner, Qualys or Nexpo's scanner may detect those vulnerabilities, but maybe there's mitigating controls in place that are preventing it from being breached. There could be certain firewall rules in place, different mitigating controls. So at the same time, it's also finding things that you may have found in your vulnerability scanner that you think is a risk, but it's not.
Well, what would be an example of something that, you know, you go into pen test? What are some of the common things that you're finding when you go do a pen test?
A lot of the things we see is vulnerabilities due to not running the latest software. Of course, there are 0 days that there's no fix for. And typically, you know, some really highly skilled pen testers are finding 0 days on pen test. And the benefit of that is if they're coming there testing that, they're finding things before it's even being added to like vulnerability scanners. So that's one of the advantages there.
And so once you're going in and if a company's, you know, do the security teams or some of these certifications, are they being trained on how to, do you have to actually be a pen tester to pen test? I mean, isn't there still ways that the security teams can do some, you know, proactive testing on what vulnerabilities there might be out there?
Sure. One of the things that they want to do and most companies do is make sure you're doing some reoccurring vulnerability scans. Because just like Microsoft has their Patch Tuesday where they're putting out these patches, also that's the same day that the threat actors are finding out how to reverse engineer those patches and how to exploit those. So there's things they can do like vulnerability scanning. But one of the things I'd advise if you're in any organization is even if you're using a third party to do your pen testing, it's a good idea to train some people internally for pen testing. And there's lots of good training out there for that. But you really want someone that's really skilled. But if you're not really skilled or experienced at it, it's going to be kind of hard to really be very effective. But some of the things you can do is if your consulting company will allow it, see if your security professionals, your staff can shadow the pen tester and kind of watch them and see what they're doing. If they allow that, it's a good learning experience for them. And I would advise even if pen testing education is good for people, whether they're going to pen test or not, they kind of get to see the risks of these different types of vulnerabilities. And so I think that's good whether you're going to work in that area or not. But if you're going to do the pen testing, they definitely need to be trained because one of the things with pen testing is if you're not careful, you can break things. You can take down different systems out of production and you don't want to do that.
So with there being such a high demand in cybersecurity, you know, practitioners in the industry, I would imagine is pen testers, are they a pretty hot commodity? Is it hard to find enough pen testers to fill all the positions that are out there?
Yes, it's kind of like in line with the other areas of cybersecurity. It's really hard to find people, and there's less pen testers and probably a little more difficult to find pen testers.
Well, Jonathan said, what is a good career background that helps people get into pen testing?
If you have like an existing security background or sysadmin background, that's one of the things that helped me. If you have like a development background, say you're a software developer, a web developer, if you have that background, you could become an application pen tester. So basically you need to know the technology before you can defend it and before you can hack into it. So you have to have that technical background. So understanding operating systems from a sysadmin level, and you don't have to spend 6 years like I did as a sysadmin and then 7 years in security before moving into that. For me, I probably would have moved into pen testing if I knew about it sooner, but it does take a lot of upfront training and stuff to get those skills because you have to understand the technology. So for instance, a good path for someone that's starting out with no experience at all, and you don't necessarily have to get the certifications, but do like A+ training to learn the computer side of things, network plus to understand the networking, and then like security plus. This kind of helps give you the basics. So once you have those different skills and knowledge down, then you can move on to performing pen tests.
So another question Jonathan said, could a non-technical person be a good pen tester?
Yes. You never know what someone's skill set is until they start learning the technology. A good example for me is actually if you go back before my sysadmin days, I went to trade school to be a CAD drafter, a computer assisted drafter. I learned AutoCAD, and this was back in 93 to 94. I had no computer skills that time, probably the worst in my class because other people had experience with computers. But by the time I got out of school, got out in the workforce, my computer skills were better than my peers as CAD drafters. I was able to figure out some of the new features of AutoCAD when it came out before my peers. Windows 95 was kind of new at the time. I was able to figure out some of the network and printing options. And so if you're non-technical, you won't know until you get in and start doing it, but you can be, you know, cause everyone that's a pen tester, you know, when I was a sysadmin, I didn't have that sysadmin background. I had to gain it. So you can come from non-technical backgrounds. As an example, on one of my podcasts, I had someone that was an esthetician. And it's like people that do these beauty treatments beyond just the regular beauty shop kind of stuff, a little more technical, requires a little more schooling for it. She was 40 years old and went to school, got an associate's degree in IT, and then got another associate's degree in cybersecurity, and then went to work as a pen tester. So she came from something totally not technical, and you really don't know how well you're going to fare until you get into it and start working with it. And maybe you hadn't been that good at technical things, but once you take a class and learn the basics and learn how it, understand how it works, then you'll get a better idea of how well you like it and how quickly you can pick up on those different types of topics.
Well, it seems to me, and I don't know, I could be wrong, but having three kids and they're all kind of spaced out. I still have a younger one that's, you know, so I have a 9-year gap between the oldest and the youngest. So a lot of things have happened during those 9 years. And the oldest one, he was a gamer, but back then it just seemed to be all boys that were gamers. Now she's 19 and she's a gamer and a lot of her friends are gamers, but my middle daughter was never a gamer. So it's, you know, times have changed and I feel like gamers are very, you know, competitive and they're always trying to win because they're on these games. Why isn't that in a sense what pen testing is doing, is that you're trying to get in there and basically win what you're trying to find? Sure. I mean, I'm just trying to put it in a layman's term. So if we have all this young generation that are out there, more gamers now, and I've even learned that like the most popular game that's out there right now is a very good game. I don't know the name of it. I just heard this morning and I know it's a game my daughter plays and it's more social stuff. That's not the bad stuff that some of these other games have had. I don't know if you know what game I'm talking about, but shouldn't we see see a rise of people getting into the industry because, you know, I try to always convince her she should go down this route of cybersecurity because she, you know, loves that kind of challenge of these games. So I guess my point is, how do we advocate for these younger generations to push into, you know, this career path? Because it could be, in a way, just like gaming.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because there's a lot of people in the industry that are into gaming that do really well at pen testing, learning how to hack. And another good way to do that is get them interested in CTFs, capture the flags, because capture the flag competitions are where you have to hack into other systems and get the flag. In some cases, it could be opportunities to work with cryptography and different other security items or topics. So that's a good place to do it. And it's interesting because there are some organizations that have created like these esports leagues and they're kind of like hacking competitions. So if you've got a young person that likes gaming, get them interested into CTFs because actually there is some of the universities have what's called CCDC. It's an attack and defend competition where you have teams trying to get into the other team's systems and vice versa. And you're trying to block. It's like a block and defend or hack and defend competition. And those are good. And there's also National Cyber League. While CCDC is only open to universities, National Cyber League, I believe, is open to like high schools too. So these are capture the flag competitions. And it's interesting, like with the National Cyber League, they keep a list of the rankings and hiring managers for companies will see these lists. If someone does well enough, it's possible that they could get a job within another company. And there's some CTFs at conferences. I had one of my friends and a really good hacker and pentester from the Dallas community. He was at a conference in Austin, I believe, and Lockheed Martin had a CTF. And if you're able to offer this, if you're able to solve the CTF, then you were like guaranteed a job within Lockheed Martin. So there's being able to perform those challenges. Like if you're wanting to apply for a pen tester, you've been doing CTFs, they will give you challenges where you're performing a pen test or a CTF to go through and see how you solve it to decide whether you have the technical chops to join their team.
Yeah, it's just so interesting. Like just another thing, I feel like this new generation, these, what do they call these young, I should know, the Gen Z, I guess.
Gen Z or Zoomers, I think, too.
Yeah, Gen Z. I think my daughter's a Gen Z. But that generation, you know, now they also have this, oh, we don't really need to go to college. We could, you know, you're seeing a big movement of that. You know, we can go to, you know, these boot camp schools and, you know, all these different types of things that are out there that I have seen work for some people. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen these boot camps work for some people and I've seen them not work for some people. I've seen educations do great for some people. And then I've seen a 4-year education do, you know, not as well for some people. So are we seeing in some of these boot camps, because coding was a big thing, you know, we saw coding boot camps, you mm-hmm. know, make a huge, you know, they're making a lot of money off of these 6-month schools. And some of these people, you know, my nephew's doing really well and because he went to one of those boot camps. So are we seeing these kind of boot camps for pen testing and some of these other specific jobs in the cybersecurity sector?
I've seen it for other jobs, but I haven't seen any specific for pen testing. So they'll cover different topics. They may cover pen testing during that, but it's almost kind of like when you mentioned the coding boot camps, they also referred those as like immersion training because you're immersed in it. That's all you're doing is stuff related to coding. But I've heard of some schools. There's one, I can't think of the name of it, that I have several people I've mentored that have went through it, that you go through it and I think you get like the security or the CompTIA CYSA or Security Plus certifications through there. You go through these training, they kind of get you prepped into a position where you can get a job. And some of them are kind of, you know, some of them can be kind of expensive, but then some of them are more geared towards giving opportunities to people that otherwise may not be afforded. But sometimes these are good ways of learning because one of the things, you know, not college, it's a good experience, but some cases, if you're going to some university, the technology that they're teaching for security may be kind of a little outdated. So that kind of makes it a challenge there. But one of the examples I like to share, one of the pass that I think is one of the best paths for cybersecurity. If you're going to go to the university route, is I would get a degree in computer science because you can learn coding and how things work. Then you can go on and get like a master's in cybersecurity or either take some certification courses or other direct training towards specific fields of specialization and learn how to pick that up. Because if you learn how to code and you're learning computer science, then there's some things you're going to be able to do that your peers, if they didn't go through that type of program, won't be able to do. And while it's not necessary, some of the best pen testers out there know how to code or write scripts. They're able to automate some of the tasks that you're doing.
Well, Jonathan had a couple of comments. One, it was just a comment saying, I heard people who like puzzles seem to really like pen testing and CTF.
That's true.
Which makes sense because again, it's that whole challenge of, you know, trying to break the code in a way, you know. And then he said, I really enjoy boot camps, but I encourage people to find the type of training they respond to and enjoy. As long as they're learning, you're improving, which is true. And we're just, I don't know if you agree with me that I just feel like this generation, it's just a different, you know, there's a sector of them that just, you know, the university is not as impactful as it was completely required for, you know, the last two generations of my kids.
Yeah. And one of the things to look at too, some of your, the big four consulting firms a few years ago eliminated the need for a four-year degree. So you could get jobs without a four-year degree. They're seeing ways of getting in, but I think the university system should be looked at and improved upon, because one of the things I used to teach at Dallas College, I taught pen testing, web app pen testing there for almost 4 years. But one of the things I ran into that my other peers, since they were purely academic teaching there, one of the things they weren't teaching students is to network, go to these different cybersecurity meetups, go to different conferences, network people. They weren't being taught this. And so, you know, it was hard for them to get jobs. So I think there's some things that are missing. I would like to see some of these programs revamped. And I understand art appreciation, music appreciation makes people more rounded. But I think if we had degree programs that were more focused on the technology, maybe really get into the writing, your English composition class is good, but we should have like some tech writing courses, have them take some project management courses, more things that will expose them to different areas of IT and cybersecurity. And that's the way I think you make a more well-rounded security or IT person, is exposing them to the different types of things. Because maybe you're really organized and you like project management. Within consulting companies and organizations, they have engagement managers or project managers that are basically working on staffing pen tests, scoping pen tests, helping build the statement of work and all this for the pen test. So there's other areas. I think the students aren't getting enough exposure to those different types of areas to really have a good formed idea of what they want to do once they complete at the university.
So do you think that because there's such a shortage of IT professionals and positions that we need in this industry, do you think that the industry needs to become more creative, just like you were talking about, you know, the big five consulting firms starting to not require degrees? For instance, I was just thinking, you know, I have a friend of mine that is a hairstylist, and I've seen that he's taken like 2 years. I think there's something in that industry that, you know, you can on the job train with a stylist and to get your license. And it's a big commitment for the person that's training them, but eventually that person ends up getting their, you know, hair license. So do you think we're going to start seeing some changes in the industry because we do need more people and we can't just sit around and wait for people to graduate from university because it's not happening fast enough?
I think we should, and that would be apprenticeships. And that's one of the things I've kind of recommended for a while when people asking about ways to help that employment gap, the skills gap. And one of the things I've recommended is apprenticeships. I talked to a company a couple years ago that do pen tests as a service, and I was talking to them about it. They said they could possibly do an apprenticeship program, but they can only have about one apprentice per 6 months. And one of the things about apprenticeships, it's like an internship. You look at internships, you're going to a college people that get out of college. So anyone listening, if you're going to college, get an internship if you can, because then you're going to have 3 months, 6 months worth of experience. And the biggest hurdle of getting a job in cybersecurity is having the experience. So I'd really love to see more apprenticeship programs. Maybe this needs to be driven by the government. I really wish more companies would do that. And for our stand, we've kind of done things like that at Alias. They've brought people in without experience that area and trained them, and they're functioning cybersecurity folks doing a great job. More companies need to do that. I know so many people are so bent on having the experience, but if you did an apprenticeship, you bring people in, you give them 90 days to learn, you come in, train them, and if they pick it up and do a good job, you can hire them full time. But if, you know, they really weren't that awesome enough to make a commitment to hire them full time, then you've given this person 3 months or 6 months worth of experience. Now they can go somewhere else and get hired.
Well, Jonathan said, yes, apprenticeships are a great way, and I would love to see more of them for new cyber people. He is the perfect example. You know, when he was a CISO over at the University of Tulsa, I've said this many times on the show, you know, he took the students and built their SOC team from the students, which is, you know, why is not every university doing that? I mean, now these kids are going to graduate. They already have, you know, on the, you know, they already have an internship because they did it at their university. And, you know, I think, doesn't some of that have to be regulated, though? If someone is going to take an apprentice on, if they're still, what are they going to get at the end of that apprenticeship? They're going to get work experience. But again, what kind of, you know, what kind of credentials are they going to get from that? It would be nice to see them earn some sort of something in the industry to make them again more, you know, just more on their resume, more ready for someone to hire them in a role that we need desperately in the industry.
Yeah. To give them some kind of certification, you'd have to create some kind of certifying body, or maybe some company that does certifications would come up with something that you were able to get this experience. But if someone does an apprenticeship, then they've got this to put on their work history. They worked at this company for, it's like a job. It's like a contract job. So this is information that they can put on their resume. And one of the things I recommend too for people starting out is to create a portfolio. We've always thought about artists, graphics designers creating portfolios, but we're really in an age now is a way to prove what you're doing and what you've even done studying wise is to write blog posts, document your education journey, you know, describe the different things you've done. If you're a pen tester, if you're doing things like CTFs and Hack the Box and Try Hack Me, document, you know, write pen test reports on those different systems that you've hacked through that education journey. And this gives you something to show a potential employer. If you like doing videos, do walkthrough videos. There's a lot of people on YouTube that are doing walkthrough videos. And a lot of these folks were just doing stuff to educate themselves or document their journey. But this is information that you can show a hiring manager. A prime example is we had a recent college grad that went to our local DEF CON group, the DEF CON 214, which is the Dallas DEF CON group. They were a recent college grad and they did a presentation on malware analysis. A hiring manager from Citigroup was in the audience, saw the presentation, asked for the resume, and they got hired. They basically did a technical interview without realizing they're doing a technical interview. But build these portfolios. If you go speak at these different groups, like I said, creating videos for YouTube, this is a good way for employers to go on your LinkedIn profile and see what you're doing. If you're comparing your LinkedIn profile to someone else and everything's identical, certifications, education is identical, if you've gone this extra step and been able to prove things through write-ups, maybe you've even created some scripts that you put on a GitHub account, you're able to document these things you're doing, you're showing that you're putting a little more effort into it, you're documenting it. And hiring managers and HR people don't have a ton of time to go through and look through every resume and every LinkedIn profile. But if they see these things in there that stand out, it's pretty much a no-brainer to pick that person to interview.
So before we got way off topic and we took a right turn here, Where something's weird is going on with LinkedIn Live today. And I had a DM, somebody messaged me because they can't get their messages on the LinkedIn. And they said, how do you navigate the legal and compliance aspects of offensive security testing to ensure that activities are conducted within the bounds of the law? It's a really good question. Yeah.
Yes. So basically, if you have the permission from the organization to pen test their company, then you're in the bounds of the law. So if someone come up and wanted you to test someone else without permission, that's totally illegal. So one of the things when you are working as a pen tester, if it's an internal organization for your company, there's really nothing that has to be signed there. But typically if you're a consulting company, then you have like your statement of work and stuff that they sign to let them know what's going on, setting the rules of engagement, the type of testing that's being performed. Because one type of testing that hardly anyone does, this is usually a requirement, a request by the customer, but people are always worried about it, is denial of service testing. And that's not typically something you could do. That could be tested. Usually the vulnerabilities will show up, whether it's, you know, vulnerable to denial of service, if you only want to test denial of service because it takes it down. But as far as staying legal, you're just, you know, you're got the agreement with the company, they're signing this paperwork. Now, if you were doing like bug bounty or something like that, you found bugs, you don't want to do that on your own, because then you're looking at, getting into some legal issues. So you want to go through someone like BugCrowd or HackerOne or Integrity to do bug bounties and follow their rules of engagement, and you'll be protected through that. So as far as just like a regular pen tester, you're a consultant, then that's something you really don't have to worry about, because you're getting agreement from the company and you want to stay within the scope of the work. Usually people don't run anything that's going to get them in trouble, but if they were to accidentally hack a different company, that's a different story. So as a pen tester, you're wanting to always test your scope. If you're doing an external pen test, you want to make sure you verify that that subnet of IP addresses belong to that customer you're testing. Because I've actually heard of some people accidentally testing the wrong company. A good example and a funny story is Jason Eastreet. He's a really well-known social engineer and pen tester. And one time he was in Lebanon and he actually hacked into the wrong bank. So they were in the same building. He hacked the wrong place. And so fortunately his customer was able to tell the other bank, hey, you got a free pen test out of the deal and nothing bad come out of it. It could have turned into something bad if the company wanted to pursue legal actions.
Well, and you know, right now I would assume, you know, that is the top of everyone's mind is, you know, I need to protect myself legally because of some of the things that we are seeing happening in the industry where we've never seen, you know, indictments on because of, you know, some breaches that have happened. So Jonathan made a good point. He said, even if you work for an organization as a pen tester, you might consider getting a formal letter or documentation saying you can perform the pen test, which I would think from a legal act, just a, you know, CYA, you know, is a very smart thing.
So typically the documents that you get from during the pen test that you have the customer sign is usually good enough. But if you're doing something like social engineering or physical pen testing, where you're going on site in risk of getting caught by security guards or even possibly law enforcement, then you can have a document like that. Sometimes they refer to as a get out of jail free card. It's showing you have permission. So you could be testing the security of a building. You're in a building and security comes along or law enforcement catches you there. You need to be able to prove that you have permission to be there, as well as this document needs to have contacts so they can contact people within the organization to prove it. Because anyone could write up a letter, forge this and carry it with them, but you need those contacts so that way they can verify. Not always they're going to trust you, because a threat actor could make a document like that, carry it with them and give it to somebody. And maybe they are, you know, work with pen test and that's good enough and they go at that, but really they should validate to make sure that it's a legit penetration test.
So what is the difference between an ethical hacker and a pen tester?
So ethical hacking is really the skills of doing the hacking. A penetration test is you're performing this assessment, documenting it in a report. And ethical hacking is just the actual act of doing the ethical hacking piece. So a penetration tester, you're running vulnerability scans, looking for other vulnerabilities and documenting those, whether they're able to be hacked or not. An ethical hacker sometimes are just going in, seeing if they can hack into something and just very limited in the scope of their reporting. But technically ethical hacking is just one of the skills that a penetration tester does. It's just kind of almost the synonymous term and easier for the general public to understand. When you tell someone they're a pen tester or a penetration tester, they're not going to have any clue what you're talking about. They may think you work for an ink pen company testing ink pens.
That's funny. Well, is there something like specifically that you've done as a pen tester in your career that, you know, you say you have to stay up all night, probably running like certain scripts on, you know, I don't even know your terminology to say, but what is something fun that you have done in your career that you're like, wow, that was really cool. And we completed our mission. Like, can you give us an example of something that just was fun and positive with a positive outcome?
Sure. One of my most favorite moments was through a database vulnerability, SQL injection vulnerability. I was doing a penetration test, and this was from the outside of an organization, from the internet. And through that SQL injection vulnerability, I was able to get CAN't command line access or a terminal on that Microsoft Windows server that was running Microsoft SQL server. I was able to dump the password hash and crack that password hash and get the administrator password of that system. So that was probably one of my most memorable and favorite moments. But as far as another experience I like to share with people, and this is a reason to pen test more frequently and do your remediation. So one of my former consulting jobs, I did an external pen test for a company and they did a good job of their remediation. But one of the things that happened is they remediated all the highs, criticals and mediums, but they had a couple low level vulnerabilities, which is normally okay to leave, but they also paid for a 90-day retest. So 90 days later, I came in to retest, and one of those low level, low criticality vulnerabilities, someone figured out how to exploit it. So I went back and did my test again. It was now a high level vulnerability. So if they only did annual pen test, no retest, that vulnerability would have been exposed for like another year. So that's one of the reasons I really like to preach remediation and why you should try to remediate everything. And also consistent testing. Make sure you're testing more frequently, not just once a year. Because if it wasn't for me doing this retest, like I said, that would have been laying out there vulnerable. So it's kind of a good lesson I learned and one I like to share with people when it comes to pen testing frequency and remediation.
So do most, like how many is it more big level, you know, enterprise companies that can afford to have a full-time pen tester on site? What would you say is the percentage of companies that have an on-site, like a hired staff pen tester?
For the big companies, it's getting pretty common. I used to work for a bank and we had like 13 or 14 pen testers in-house. And we're also using consulting companies. And sometimes it can kind of help with the cost because if you're doing everything purely through consulting, it can get pretty expensive. So I see a lot of people in some cases, they may have someone on staff that pen testing is not their only role. And maybe they're doing other security items and once or twice a year or more frequently than that, they perform some pen testing. So sometimes it's a part-time role internally. That's like a lot of the IT roles. You've seen some of these smaller companies compared to the enterprises. The enterprises, people are more siloed because they can find specialists to work in these areas. There's so much work they can do that. But some of these smaller companies, they may only have limited staff. So people are wearing multiple hats, doing multiple roles.
So, one of the big trends that I've seen over the past, really ever since post-COVID, is so many CISOs and so many people going out and doing their own thing. Is there a huge need because people can't afford to have a full-time person? Are these, I have no idea if these people, you know, that leave their big job with a big company and go out on their own, do you see a success rate in that?
Yeah, I've seen several people that have been successful with that. One of my former coworkers from my first pen test job, he got laid off from a company and decided to go in business for himself. And he's actually doing contracting for a former employer and he's staying busy with that full time. One of the things that you can do there, like with the contract work, he was making more than he was making as a W-2 employee, but he can also take on other work. While he was working for that company, all he could do is work for them. So he's limited the companies he could do pen tests. So as a free agent, you know, owning your own company, you know, you could do contract work, you can do pen tests for several other companies, And, you know, you can end up making a lot more money because, for instance, you know, some companies, and this is kind of a more reasonable lower end of the charge, is I've seen companies that are charging, you know, $300 an hour or more. And some of these people with their own businesses are going in charging $200 an hour, able to charge less money and getting work because some of these organizations can't pay the $300 or $400 an hour for a pen tester. So I see people being successful with it, but you have to be a really good self-starter and make sure you continue to get business, maximize your networking opportunities to continue to keep that work coming in.
So are the companies generally relying on those, you know, I guess they'd be, I just went blank, their interim CISO or whatever they would call it because it's a contractor. Are they relying on those CISOs or those contractors to push them to the right vendor company or, you know?
Yeah, I would say some case like that. That's kind of what Jonathan does. He's our CISO, but he also does VCISO work. And
VCISO, yeah. That's what I was trying to get to. Yeah.
So these virtual CISOs are helping show them, push them in the right direction. They may have some recommendations. Someone like Jonathan works for Alias. So of course he could share the services there, but say if someone is, you know, like was mentioned earlier, like Alan, for instance, you know, Alan works for a company, but a lot of guys like him will go off and start their own company just purely doing VCISO for several companies. That's all they're doing. But then they would push them towards other consulting company for those type of services. They would usually have some kind of partnership that, they kind of use them for VCISO, and then they recommend them for the other companies for consulting.
It's very interesting. It's just times have changed so much in the last 3 to 4 years. I think people are just, there's such a high need, a high demand. Again, that this wasn't really the place we meant to go on this conversation, was talking about the shortage in the industry. But I think, you know, there's so many opportunities for people to do, you know, so much more, you know, in the industry, from a income wise, because there's a lot of opportunities for people that cannot afford a full-time CISO, a full-time pen tester. So I haven't seen a lot of, you probably have seen more than me, you know, pen testers that are out there on their own, but I would imagine that is a really nice role to probably be in, as long as you have the business side to you and you can get in the door to those places.
Yeah, that would be the main thing, because some of the difficulties I see for some folks is some pen testers, like a lot of technical, really technical folks, sometimes can be really introverted and shy. So getting out there and getting the business can be kind of difficult. And, you know, you have to be a self-starter and you know, really be structured to do that type of thing. So that's a lot of reasons why a lot of us work for companies instead of doing our own thing. There's more money to do it on your own, but there's a higher risk too.
That's why there's a lot of people that attend our events virtually, because it's easier for them to go virtual than come out and be intimidated by all the people that are at our events. But we are down to about 2 minutes left here. And is there any like last words that you would want to give to our listeners of how to stay on the offensive side before you have to act on the defensive side?
Yeah. So one of the things I would say is educate yourself. Even if you're not, if you don't want to be a pen tester, there's good resources out there. Learn, you know, watch, go to some conferences, see some offensive security talks. If you don't want to get into learning pen testing, then there's resources like the MITRE ATT&CK framework. And MITRE ATT&CK kind of shows you how the threat actors are working, the type of attacks they're using, and the type of industries they're going after, and also some good cyber threat intelligence. Good to keep up with cyber threat intelligence to see what kind of companies they're attacking and the type of different tactics, techniques, and procedures that they're doing, so you can kind of keep up with that. So you can understand the offensive mind without actually becoming a pen tester.
Well, Philip, it was so great to have you on the show again. Hopefully we'll see you in Dallas at the end of the month. And are you guys having any cold weather over in Dallas right now?
Yeah, it's been pretty cold for us. It started out this morning in the 20s. It's up to 42. We were supposed to get a high of
for you guys. 60,
but yeah, it's really cold. We're supposed to have some days in the teens next week. So
I think it's making its way through the country. So
it is.
Yeah. Well, Philip Wiley, he's the director of security over at Alias Cybersecurity. Thank you so much for being on our show again. And thank you everyone for tuning in today. And I hope you all have a warm weekend wherever you are. I hope you stay warm, stay safe, stay secure. And we will see you next week for another episode of And Security for All. So have a great weekend, everyone.
Thank you for tuning into And Security for All. Be sure to join your host, Kim Hakim, for another episode of the show next Friday at noon Pacific Time and 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And don't forget, you can follow Kim on LinkedIn by searching for Kim Hakim. That's Kim, H-A-K-I-M, to keep yourself posted on all of her upcoming cybersecurity events. Are you a cybersecurity professional that needs to earn continuing educational hours? FutureCon Events brings high-level cybersecurity training, discovering cutting-edge security approaches, managing risk in the ever-changing threat of the cybersecurity workforce. Cybersecurity is no longer just an IT problem. To learn more about attending a virtual event, go to futureconevents.com or email info@futureconevents.com. Or follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter at FutureConHQ. Don't miss the weekly FutureCon Seamless podcast series, focusing on the insights and thoughts of chief security officers and industry pioneers making a difference throughout the world. Kim Hakim, CEO of FutureCon Events, and Darren Anderson, CEO and co-founder Next Robotics, host Seamless Podcast, started by a team of entrepreneurs with experience in fields like smart cities, technology, cybersecurity. The result is a series of podcasts unlike anything you've ever heard anywhere. Listen where you get your podcasts, including Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher.